Welcome to Just Now Possible with Teresa Torres.
I'm Priya Nakra. I'm the founder and product lead of Override Labs, which is a nonprofit that's focused on building technology to prevent harm from gender-based violence. Before starting Override, I was working in tech as a product lead for about 10 years, working at startups, large companies, everything from fintech to gaming and media.
I'm Olivia Rowley. I'm proud to work with Priya on Override Labs as her AI advisor and board member. I have been helping think through some of the things like how do we do evals? What does the safety rubric look like and requirements on just the customer experience of the product? I currently work in AI. I've worked in tech for 10 plus years now in a variety of roles. Priya and I used to work together at Netflix. That's how we met. But yeah, happy to be here.
Excellent. Okay, tell me a little bit about Override Labs.
Yeah, definitely. So Override Labs was founded basically to become the prevention infrastructure for how AI advancements, technological advancements can really introduce a disproportionate harm to women and children. We've seen that with various other AI products who are too quick to go to market without doing the proper red teaming and understanding what the impact is. So that kind of came about of, it was just me saying, either naively or not, what if we did AI for good, for a good cause, not just for raising the bottom line or having some sort of growth and revenue metrics to uphold? I was chosen for an incubator program from a new philanthropy-based fund called the Fund to Prevent Sexual Assault. And they had a very specific charter of building technology or digital tools specifically to prevent sexual assault in the high school age demographic, so like 15 to 19 years old. So that was like, it was nice to have like a well-scoped problem statement. And that's where the flagship product, which we'll talk about today, came about. But as I started building out more of the flagship product, it became pretty clear that there is room for an ecosystem or sort of a platform type of prevention infrastructure for this cause specifically. So that's a little bit about the company.
And had you already identified this domain and then you found the incubator, or did finding the incubator pull you into the domain?
It was actually a bit of both, because as I was in a job search in the summer of last year and at the same time learning more about, like I said, those sort of disproportionate harms that are happening with like new, like AI specific or technology specific advancements. And then it was like kismet timing where they also had the open call for the incubator. So it was like bringing my technology into this new domain in order to kind of create this idea.
Yeah, this is something I'm hearing a lot from people. It's something I'm like a thread I've been pulling on lately, which is a lot of people that have worked in tech for a long time, there's a little bit of this kind of backlash against the tech industry. I recently released a podcast episode on my other podcast, All Things Product, where my co-host Petra Villa and I had a debate about, is technology good? Mm-hmm. And for somebody who's been in technology my whole life, like historically, yeah, I always would have said yes. But we're kind of in this period where there's also a lot of yuck, and it's getting harder and harder to say yes. And so I know a lot of folks are asking these exact same questions of like, how can I take my tech skills and get away from this kind of corporate greed piece and use it for the community and for the greater good? So I'm excited to get into your story and just like how you went from, this is something I would like to do, to I'm actually doing this. Do you want to share a little bit there?
Yeah, definitely. It was really about taking a step back, actually. Like, I thought there would be some kind of like clarity moment where I would decide, okay, now I am in this domain as a founder. But it actually kind of happened over time, like over a transition time where I was still like in between two domains or in between these two worlds. And then once I started building out the product more, also seeing what it was like personally to be a solo founder and build out this new company with like great advisors, obviously, it just felt really good. I felt like a lot of momentum. I felt a lot of like passion for the subject, obviously. And so that's kind of how it became like my full-time job now, is like actually running this organization and building out these more products. And I'm sure we'll talk about it. What started as one product, which was like specifically built for like primarily for teenage boys, has become like an ecosystem strategy so that you can prevent sexual assault, but using like various different personas. So that engine has been able to repeat itself across multiple products, which is really exciting as well.
the questions you had about is technology good? Something about this I think is really interesting is the kind of theory of technology being a way to deliver things at scale. This is now delivering at scale something that in the past was really only a bespoke one-to-one person type of thing. And so even the idea of is technology good is it depends on what the technology is delivering. Because there's lots of things that technology in and of itself is neutral, maybe. Maybe that's a hot take. I don't know. Yeah. But it depends on what it is delivering that to answer that question.
My take on this was I actually think technology is good. I would go further than it's neutral. Mm-hmm. But that maybe the tech industry is where the problem arises. And that one of the things I really love about AI is it's changing the economics of software development. And I think this product that we're going to get into is a perfect example of this in that, like, it's clearly a product that's going to create good for the world, but it may not be the best business. And like Priya, you mentioned you're starting as a nonprofit. Historically, to build software, it cost millions of dollars. We had to hire engineers. It took lots of years. And it was way too expensive. And the only people that developed software was for problems that were good businesses. And so I actually really am excited about this new world where we actually, all of us, can create software for fairly low cost. And then what does that unlock? I was actually really excited to interview both of you because this is a thread I've been pulling on of maybe we all now can use our tech skills to make our communities better. And how exciting is that? Even if we still work at a corporation and need to make money, and that's fine too, right? But we can actually balance it with let's find more good uses of technology.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just to piggyback off of what you said, I do think it's more the technology as an avenue is good, but the industry where it is today, because everybody's prioritized on getting first to market and obviously making as much money as possible, the safety measures are going down by the wayside. So now there's a general feeling that AI equals unsafe. And part of the development of this product was, what if you built it in a way where, and we'll talk about this in the Is This Okay product specifically, but where you could have a judgment-free zone, but without being able to be coerced by a bad actor user. Or you can be able to ask private thoughts and get as much information as possible without having a sycophantic response, because that's the kind of stuff that kind of rubs people the wrong way when it comes to AI. So I think it's definitely the industry and it's like how it's implemented. And I'm not saying for sure I've hacked it, not at all, but that was the intent around it, was like I was only going to go with an AI solution if I knew that I could help prevent the worst case scenario of a bad actor using the product.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to get into this a little bit. I know you've done a good job of explaining your broad domain of reducing gender violence. That's enormous.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit, like, how did you go from that to a very specific challenge to address?
In general, in the U.S., sexual assault in this particular demographic of the high school age kids has been on the rise. And that's why I think the Fund to Prevent Sexual Assault really focused the incubator cohort on that specific demographic. And it really started with, I know some people in the program are focusing on female perpetrators and male victims as an example. But something I was really, maybe it's my product management kind of mindset, building a business case, understanding the total addressable market. The U.S. majority pattern is that the victims are normally girls and women. So that's why I wanted to start with that as a big problem and then start to understand, okay, why would somebody under 18 or 19 actually commit this assault? And there's tons of different reasons that go across the spectrum. One is the most extreme, which is obviously we're hearing about the manosphere, we're hearing about red pill communities, and there's a lot of misogyny there. But then the other side is like maybe they've never had consent education before in schools or just any sort of structured way. But then there's also an in-between where there is consent education, they're hearing about that a little bit, but then they're also being influenced by all these other forces, either on the internet and otherwise. And so really trying to understand the mindset of a young boy and everything that they're going through when it comes to these types of situations. And that's where I felt like there was, maybe because me personally, I understood it the least. That's why I wanted to dig into it the most and understand like how big of a problem is this? How big of a driver of this is this kind of confusion around sexually ambiguous scenarios? And that's sort of drove a lot of the data too. 93% of juvenile sexual assault in those scenarios, the victims know their perpetrator, right? It's not a stranger. It's somebody who's known to them. And that because it's usually somebody else that they know, it's pretty reasonable to think that some of this harm comes from confusion and mixed signals, not necessarily clear pre-planned malicious intent. And so using that kind of Jungian hypothesis is how I drove into what kind of solution can I provide for that particular type of teenage boy so that he doesn't cross physical boundaries and potentially it decreases the amount of assault happening.
One thing I'll also comment on about this is what I find is super interesting about being in a space where you don't have a lot of context just from your day-to-day job or background, like not having gone to medical school or being social workers, you can't make assumptions in the same way when you're building the tech product. Like everything is, why is it like that? Why do they do that? Why are people like this? Which is interesting when we're all more used to consumer tech and you can make assumptions about how you are as a customer, but this customer is a very different one. This is a teenage boy, which we are not. And so you really can't make assumptions because you don't know that customer as your own person.
Yeah, my discovery brain is like very excited about this. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit, how did you learn? This feels like a very sensitive area. Mm-hmm. And I can imagine you can't just go ask a teenage boy, tell me about an ambiguous situation. Tell me a little, like, how did you learn about this space?
Yeah, the first step was honestly like scraping a lot of subreddits, like teenager specific or very like frequently visited by teenagers. So the teenager subreddit, the dating advice subreddit. And I did about, when I was doing this back in January, pretty much, I did a scrape of the last 2000 posts in each Reddit or in each subreddit and classified them high level into how many of these scenarios that people are asking about, because a lot of teenagers ask like very long, detailed questions in these forums. Sometimes it's like the only way that they feel like they can get objective advice from people that aren't, have some sort of bias because the person they're talking about, like their friends already know. So that's why these subreddits and even Discord, there's quite a few channels that are like really popular for teenage dating and like teenage dating advice. So I looked at a lot of those and basically high level grouped them into how many of these posts are actually like consent related or coercion related. And there were quite a few. So I think that sort of validated that theory that when the community is present, at least like the teenagers will use it. They will ask these types of questions. It's just a matter of, is the advice they're getting timely enough? And also like consent informed and like the right like kind of answer and the right kind of advice. So that was like the first piece that kind of validated that. And then in addition to that, I, in very early prototypes, did some like product / usability testing with 18-year-olds, just doing like digital recruitment, 18-year-old boys, and just asked a bunch of various different questions of them. How do they feel? Or what's their level of consent education before using the tool? Reading a scenario, seeing how confident they felt about either like pursuing something physically and then using the tool and seeing if that attitude like shifted at all. Obviously, this is like really proxy. This is really just directional. We'll have to do like a real longitudinal study in the long term to actually observe if behaviors shifted over a certain period of time. But at least directionally, after using the product, people took more of a cautious next step as opposed to a like confident next step in terms of what the next like physical step is for this particular scenario. So it felt like even just getting that moment to pause and reflect, think about things, helped them think things through in a way that like is less likely to cause physical harm.
Yeah, this is fascinating. I like that. I guess I'm not terribly surprised that teenagers ask these questions on the internet. That's terrifying to me, especially if I think about Reddit totally. In particular. But what a great source of just research input. Mm-hmm. And then I really like that you almost came up with this just simulation. It's almost like a psych study of, okay, here's a scenario, what would you do? And then now let's give you some feedback and some interaction. And now let's see how that changes your behavior. So it sounds like you were able to at least get some, I'm going to say market research around who your audience is, what they're comfortable doing today. That study that you just described, is that I know you have a clinician who helped you. Was that the study that the clinician helped you with? You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I have a clinical advisor he's a licensed therapist who actually works with young men with problematic sexual behaviors. So he helped me design like high level what that study is. Of course, like again, with the whole caveat that this is purely directional, and in order to actually measure behavior change, it needs to be for a much longer period of time. And he also helped come up with the eval rubric just to make sure that the types of risk vectors and dimensions we were grading on were the right ones to be looking at. Because based on his experience talking about these types of, as you said, sensitive situations, a lot of it comes down to the tone you're using. Are you inviting and not indicting as part of this conversation that you're having with someone who is possibly could perpetrate something like this or maybe already has? So that's like a lot of guidance he's given me so far.
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating to me about this is such a charged topic, I think, from both directions, right? From both genders is what I mean by both directions. I think for women that are often the victim of gender violence, it can feel like if there's like these consent boundaries that are crossed, there was clearly malicious acts. And I
Yep.
think for a lot of men, it can feel like, no, there's a lot of gray here, and I don't have malicious intent. There's a lot of gray. There's also a lot
Yeah.
of emotion and a lot of arousal. And there's a lot of other factors that are happening in that exact moment. And especially when we talk about teenagers. So I really loved, like, in your application, you wrote a lot about how do you build a tool that allows people to learn about these scenarios and even situations they've been in and reflect on them without shame. And I think
Right.
that's like a really compelling part of this is just acknowledging that, like, probably in the vast majority of cases, these are just humans trying to be human, and humanness is messy. So tell
Exactly.
me a little bit, was that, did your clinical advisor help with that? What was, is that in the research? Where, tell me a little bit about how did you like stumble on that as part of your potential solution?
Yeah, high level, the prevention field is. They always say a lot, like a good majority of sexual assault is preventable, not inevitable. And so then it becomes a whole, if you understand that, if you believe in that, it goes to exactly what you're saying. Not everybody, especially teenagers, are going to be out of this, coming out of this with malicious intent to assault. That doesn't mean that's never the case. We've seen that's the case. And they're definitely the most widely understood study is they classify four different types of rape perpetrators, and only one of them is actually more preventable than the other, more coachable than the other. But yeah, in general, I working with the clinical advisor for sure helped me understand this. But also I also worked with a couple of other kind of positive masculinity coaches who've worked with young men like this who either, again, already feel like they've been quote unquote canceled or isolated based off of an incident, and walking them through, talking them through what's actually happening. And one of them, his name is Misha, we were working together. The initial version of the prototype, I basically had a red flag list within the system prompt, said if the input has any one of these words that are degrading towards women, like immediately stop, address that they shouldn't be talking about women like that, and then go from there. And when I told him about that experience, he was like, if you're going to stop them in the first time they're experiencing the product, like they'll not want to open up and continue. So you can acknowledge that that type of language is not great, but you do it in a way that asks you or asks them instead, what do you want out of this relationship? What does this person mean to you? What do you want them to mean to you? To get them to see them as like more human and have that kind of conversation, as opposed to immediately being like, no, you shouldn't say that about women, and then shutting down the conversation, and then they never want to have that kind of conversation with the product again. So there were a lot of things like that, but that's probably the most like top of mind specific change where like as soon as I had the conversation with him, I was like, yeah, we got to do something about that. So we're still clocking the degrading language list. We're just not shutting the conversation down from the first step.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. I like this. It seems like a very, like, you have to meet your user where they are.
Exactly.
But in a very like sensitive, maybe extreme context. Maybe not always extreme, but like sensitive context.
Yeah, there's like very thoughtful caution built in, like how the product is built is a very is thoughtful in the like risk and triage thinking so that we get the user to the right place, whether it's, hey, we need to dig in a little more, understand what you're experiencing right now and why you think like you're here for a reason. Something is feeling off to you, rather than to Priya's point, like the indicting, like we don't immediately want to be like, yeah, this is bad. okay, then why are they in this app right now? They should, they're here because they want coaching through something.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, is like anybody who's even willing to use a product like this clearly is open to some sort of reflection and learning, which is a pretty strong signal that like they probably aren't your malicious perpetrator.
Exactly. Yeah, this product is definitely not meant to or built to reach, let's just say, like the already red-pilled young man, because to your both of your point, like they're not in a position where they want to stop and reflect because they already have some sort of like harmful views towards women. Yeah. So it's built for a very specific type of teenage persona. But again, going back to the stats of that 93% of the perpetrator knowing the victim, like on a personal level, really stuck with me, because it's like, you can't assume that like the majority of those are going to be malicious intent. It's like a lot of those are going to be confusion in the moment. Maybe there was alcohol involved. Maybe there's a power imbalance. Maybe there's an age difference. Like all of these things that could lead to a boundary getting crossed between two teenagers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to your study, because it sounds like you already had a prototype even at that stage. So tell me a little bit about just what did the product look like at that point? What was your first prototype? How did you start to evaluate we can really do something meaningful here with AI?
Something I learned like during the prototyping as well, going back to your point about meeting your user where they're at. 1 in 8 teenagers in the US is already using a generative AI solution to talk about these emotional kinds of conversations, whether that's like about relationships, about dating, about sex, about parents, whatever. Now, whether or not like ChatGPT, for example, is like the best version of that is like probably up for another debate. But that also helped me solidify that this kind of infrastructure for those like private, trustworthy conversations already exists for this type of demographic. So it gave me like a little bit more confidence that people might actually want to use it, especially if it speaks to them in a way that, again, is inviting, not judgmental, but not necessarily giving anybody a permission slip to cause harm or justify harm. So yeah, the initial versions of the prototype were like early version was really just like a wrapper around like Claude. It was like just a free text chat. And it was like some branding around that this is a teenage focused tool where you can talk about specific sensitive scenarios. And it's evolved because what I realized really quickly is when you have people like free text write out a scenario, especially one of these sensitive ones, usually you have the same like set of follow-up questions, which is like what I was mentioning before. Is there an age difference, power imbalance, alcohol or drugs involved? Like at what stage in the physical journey are you guys? So now it's like, it helped shape the product how it is now, which is like, it starts with free text. Like that's the default experience. But then based off of the content there's what I call like safety floor questions, because obviously any of those types of questions being true, like the power imbalance or intoxication, kind of drives whether or not this actually could be a consenting physical interaction or not. So that those questions get asked based on what the free text actually says. There's also a guided mode, but honestly, most people don't use that because I think people are really comfortable with like landing on an AI tool, seeing a chat box and being able, like once they see a description or once they see suggestion chips underneath the free text, knowing, okay, this is the type of scenario that I need to be like using the product for.
Yeah. Okay. So let's get a little bit into what does it look like today? I know you shared in your application some of the different layers you have. You want to just describe, somebody comes, they use your app, they start to tell their story. What happens next?
I will mention too, based on the type of experience it is, because the model doesn't really need to do anything in the outside world. There's no like application of any more like fashionable AI patterns, like no agents, no MCP, like nothing like that. It's very specific. It doesn't need to call anything other than like the modular functions that I have it in an external instance of Supabase, and the system prompt that also lives inside of those functions. So the core flow is like very finite. Like I said, they're collecting the narrative. And then before we even call Claude, the risk is classified like deterministically. There's like hard-coded rules as part of the journey that the narrative goes through. And then that response gets generated appropriate to the risk tier that we're talking about. And then that's actually when we call Claude and we say, here's the whole situation. It's this risk. Here's the sort of like narrative around it. This is what we want to say. This is the structure we want to say it in. And then if the user has follow-up questions, that hits a different function. Again, same place, but like different function that also then hits Quad after it looks at the initial version of the follow-up questions.
Yeah, so let's talk about this risk classification. I know a big piece of this is around safety. Do you want to just talk a little bit about where did that come from? How did you identify the right categories?
I might have mentioned this earlier, but for better or for worse, once I had the idea of this, I started with not to establish a North Star. It's almost like a South Star. This is the thing you want to avoid at all costs. And the thing you want to avoid at all costs is somebody using this tool to either cause harm or justify harm. And so once I started with that, is like, this is the worst case scenario. I built on top of that. How do we avoid that? How do we build in rules, hard rules that are hard coded before, again, that we actually invoke the AI at all. So the risk classification really started as pretty simple, like red flag, yellow flag. Initially, there was a green flag, but now critically, the system will never respond with any sort of thumbs up, go for it message. There's no concept of a green flag. It's like neutral, if anything, but it still has a lot of disclaimer knowledge of, or disclaimer language about talking to the other person, what consent actually is. And then based off those inputs, which is like obviously the free text narrative, but like I mentioned, if the alcohol is involved, if there's an age gap, power imbalance, this also was advised by not just my clinical advisor, but the leads of the fund, because they're both public health professionals. So they kind of helped me shape that these are the kind of main factors that you'd want to be asking for. That if you are asking somebody about a sensitive situation, you're going to be asking these types of questions in order to actually get to a point where, was this consensual? Was the other person really vocal about that this one was supposed to be consensual? It's always those kinds of factors. The combination of those factors are really what make up the risk classification function, like inside of the tool. And that's what generates the, and also that's what the evals are testing too, is did we not only get the tone right and the follow-ups right, but did we actually classify it properly based off of the inputs that the user's giving?
And then are you giving Claude guidance based on that classification? So if it's a red flag, follow this pattern. If it's a yellow flag, follow this pattern.
Yeah, I can talk a little bit to the evals. Obviously, it would be really easy if the response was just like, hey, that's a bad thing. Like every time it was deemed a bad thing, but there's so many, like, this is ambiguous in nature and so very challenging to kind of get in like a one shot. And so providing evals that run the gamut of like situational assessment, risk assessment, safety, kind of severity, like thinking of all of the different ways that could manifest. And then using those like 2000 examples from Reddit as like an input and the clinical guidance as an input. Okay, what are the sort of like different types of conversations that could happen and what looks good and what is not okay. And like what I think is really unique about this too is like you're bringing the person along in getting more information. So it's not just like a reveal of, oh, you made a bad choice. It's like prompting and conversation about, do you think they felt this way? Or what was your take on this experience? Or what does this person mean to you? And bringing them along so that it's not a asking someone to say a bunch of things and then having a sort of like judgment at the end.
Yeah, you're not scoring them. You're helping them
We're not
reflect on their
scoring them.
experience.
Exactly. So, yeah, that's an important part because it is as these frontier models are getting so great, and a lot of them do really great things on their own in certain areas, like deep research is really good for certain tools. They're not purpose-built in this kind of way in these very specific niche scenarios where this level of attention to detail is so critical, and not everything needs an LLM, also.
The thing that stood out to me about what you just described, Olivia, is this idea of what is the goal of the conversation? And that, like, I can imagine I could take a Reddit post from a teenager and throw it into Claude and say, what do you think? And I haven't really told Claude what the goal of the conversation is. And that's analogous to a teenager almost like putting their story in Claude and saying, what do you think? Like, the teenager doesn't even know the goal of their conversation. Whereas I think one thing that's nice about having a product around this is you can use clinical experience, you can use research to frame the conversation in a way that drives a specific outcome of let's reduce gender violence. And I think that goal is obviously there's probably way more to it than just setting that goal, but I can see how start like making it really clear for the model that this is the goal of this conversation could have a really big impact.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
No, that's a really good point. And yeah, one thing that I know your initial question was about, like, what did we instruct Claude to do? One of the, and this is also with the involvement of the clinical advisor I'm working with, there's a style of communication that's like often used in therapy, which is called motivational interviewing. It's really meant to be about like a non-judgmental, empathetic communication style, especially around like ambiguous or ambivalent feelings. And so there's a few guiding principles that have the core spirit of that motivational interviewing, which is showing that there's a collaborative relationship or a collaborative partnership, that there is acceptance, like not unconditional acceptance, but there is acceptance of what the situation's happening. And then evoking either follow-up questions or things that you want them to reflect on. So for a lot of the scenarios that you go through, you'll see it three-pronged like that, where it's this is what I heard, validating what I heard. This is what the other person may feel without necessarily getting to a risk of AI impersonation or anything like that. And then here's what your kind of like next step is. But really the next step is around like your own self-reflection. And then if the user says, I need more help with this, that's when they can engage like in the follow-up pretext. Or they could even say, that's actually not what I was like talking about. You got it wrong. We need to like divert from there. But that's like that tiered structure, that defined structure that most of the results actually like from Claude will actually follow.
Yeah, so a few things come into mind right away. It's really obvious to me that you've done a lot of research in this space. You've had some experts guide you. I can imagine you have almost like a rubric for how these conversations go that probably aligns with what a therapist would do in this situation. I think there's a few things that come to mind. And I can like, one, I can see how you can attach evals to that. We have a rubric. We can write evals to that rubric. We can look at our We have a whole set of Reddit data that we can use almost as our data sets and evaluate our rubric and evaluate our responses. There's still something in the back of my head that's making me wonder. I both see the appeal of LLMs, especially LLMs on Rails, not just OpenChatGPT and Open Claude, in these mental health situations. And I know in this case, we're just reflecting on a scenario. It's not, there's a mental, I don't even want to say illness, but I want to say a mental challenge per se. But this is still a little bit of a dicey area of is it, and obviously you mentioned sycophancy, that's one part of this, but also, and don't get me wrong, I have all these same concerns with human therapists. Like, how do we know that this is helping? And I'm curious just how you wrestle with this. At like a real shallow level, you can obviously do evals and be like, yep, it follows the rubric. But you've done so much research. I suspect you've thought about this at a deeper level. Just share with me your thoughts on how do you wrestle with what impact is this having?
Yeah, definitely. No, I have all the same sort of qualms and quandaries you're bringing up as well. But also to your point, like the results that the product gives, it's never a go do this type recommendation. It's really is here's what I'm understanding. Here's what I think you should think about. So it's like almost kind of non-controversial in that way, but it's still meant to be really helpful because again, it's like objective advice, whereas like the friend group chat might be more subjective, or if you're posting on Reddit, you're waiting for a long time for like half decent answers or something like that. So it's really like about the access, the trust, and again, that sort of non-controversial push towards being more cautious as opposed to being more confident around proceeding with a physical step. But I think your point about like, how do you know this is working? That's definitely where the longitudinal study comes in. But I think what's really interesting about moving from like pure technical product management to now prevention is when you're like head of product at a startup, you kind of understand if something's working. There's some metric you have to hit. And if it's going up and to the right, it's working. Here in prevention, you are measuring the absence of something, which not only is really hard to do, but it's also really like it takes a long time to do. So that's definitely something I'm still grappling with in terms of, like I said before, can we do some sort of like quick and dirty usability studies, product studies, sentiment analysis like I've done before to see is there some sort of directional shift with a real like keen understanding that the way people are answering it isn't maybe not the way that they would actually act in that particular scenario. And then in the long term, actually doing that sort of longitudinal study where you're basically referencing the same like users as part of the user study, just like over multiple months and seeing, do they come back to the product on their own? Do they like organically recommend it to friends, like depending on what the situation is and things like that. So it's definitely going to take some time and like more diligence on my side, more working with, again, my clinical advisor, the other public health professionals and the other prevention professionals to like figure out what those metrics are. But that's definitely, again, my product mind is, I don't know if this is working. So it's like a little uncomfortable, more uncomfortable than usual. But the other thing too is that one of the leads of the fund, her name is Jess, she keeps having to remind me, like, you're not trying to find the prevention solution. You're trying to find a prevention solution
Yeah.
because this is an area where every intervention can help. Whereas again, that's like opposite of Silicon Valley product management, where you're
Yeah.
like, I want to like deal with the biggest problem first. No, this actually one prevention actually does mean something. And it's meant to be, the prevention industry, especially for sexual assault, is meant to be a comprehensive like collection of solutions. So that, because you're not always going to have, this product is not going to reach every teenager, right? But it's going to reach some of them. And then hopefully the other teenagers that didn't get this product get a different type of prevention product. So that's kind of how I think about it.
Yeah, one thing that also comes to mind is I know you have this large set of data from Reddit that you can use to evaluate your, I'll just say model performance for lack of a better term, your product performance. I imagine this is an area where I'm going to frame it this way. When I first learned about AI products and I learned that all these companies are logging like all of our conversations and looking at traces and doing error analysis, I was like, of two minds. My discovery brain was like, this is amazing. You get to see so much of what customers are doing. And my like ethical side was like, holy crap, companies are not very transparent that this is what they're doing. And I have some significant ethical issues with that. I can imagine in a sensitive area that you're probably not either one, you have found a very clever way to get consent on that, or you're not even using actual real traces at all. Tell me how you think about this.
Yeah, definitely. Again, like putting yourself in the shoes of the core user, it's somebody who has been ruminating on a situation, doesn't have the right answers, doesn't know where to turn possibly, and just wants to discuss in a judgment-free zone, in a private zone, like a very sensitive situation to them. So that alone made me think from a data retention or observability perspective, what's the least amount I can log to make sure that the, just to make sure the product is doing what it intends to do and isn't erroring out. And so at the basis, all we're really logging is what are they actually submitting and what the AI is responding with. And every response is, obviously there's a session ID to make sure that it's within the same session time that the same user is doing it, but everything else is just generalized anon ID. There's no IP logging, there's no account creation, there's no PII, obviously. And hopefully that lack of account creation too is a big feature into why people are willing to try it more often, as opposed to your typical LLMs like ChatGPT. Those ones like want to monetize you, if not now in the future, but in the future. So they want to retarget you. This is not one of those tools where like I personally have any interest in retargeting for some different reason, like from a monetization standpoint. And also retargeting for a tool like this. That's the other thing, like your classic kind of consumer product metrics of like re-engagement. You don't necessarily want people to keep coming back to the product like near, right? It's like it should be a specific scenario that you shouldn't be discussing. And not that you shouldn't be, but it's not necessarily a success metric if like a bunch of people are coming back like over and over again. So yeah, that's where I started, was like, what's the least amount I can do, but just to keep making sure it's working. And one other thing too is, because I was doing like a lot of social media campaigns, like some promoted posts and stuff, I couldn't do anything on the Meta platform because they require actually like pixel tracking. And if I wanted to implement pixel tracking, I also would have had to implement a cookie consent banner. And I think even that, like the presence of the cookie consent banner is like, because like I've known for a fact, like I've seen that maybe the banner's there, but are you actually not deleting all of the cookies related to the user? Not that I've done that, but just saying, like, I
Yeah,
know
you
that
can
that
see
has
it in your
happened
browser
before.
data.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's why I was like, I'll be able to advertise on like other platforms, Snapchat, Reddit, TikTok, but just avoided the Meta platforms for this particular reason.
I think too, just like the privacy by design of the product, like the fact that we aren't tracking session over session, like we don't have that same burden that the classic LLM, like the classic LLM experience is I need to know you forever and I need to know everything about you so that context is always carried over and I'm always learning more and more about you to be more useful. And this doesn't require that. And that helps us because it reduces the friction to just get started. Like, yeah, we don't have to get you to log into anything. We don't have to be like, hey, remember that conversation we had a few months ago? It's like, nope, this is a new situation. We can talk about it in an isolated moment. And that's, it helps, like, exactly what Priya was saying. You don't have to do all of the, like, login, cookies, tracking, like, the things that really make it seem like, oh, I am being, like, looked at more intensely than I am. Which, yeah,
it's amazing what changes when your goal isn't to mine your users for as much money as possible.
Yeah, it's one of those products too. It's just like with therapy or being on some kind of medication, like the goal is to get off of it. The goal is to eventually have customers who use this to not need it anymore because they're coming to conclusions on their own about, you know what, that seemed ambiguous or this is a dodgy situation, I'm going to just clear off. That's great. If people come to those conclusions and they learn through this tool, then they don't need to come back.
Yeah. What? Tell me a little bit about this. I know, Priya, you mentioned advertising. Mm-hmm. This seems like a tough audience. They're obviously going to Reddit. You're seeing them exhibit this behavior already. But it seems like a tough audience to reach. And especially, you're two women. Like, you're not in that masculinity sphere of what's happening on the internet right now. How are you reaching out to this audience?
Yeah, it's, I will just say it's been like varying levels of success. Like some creative assets you'll put on Reddit are like, do actually resonate, have a high click-through rate. Some you just get like endlessly trolled on and you like got to turn the ad off. You say that was like not a successful asset. But I would say it is a really hard audience to reach. And I think obviously like if you're doing a Reddit or TikTok, you can only target so much, like for obvious reasons and good reasons, they don't let you target like people under a certain like age because you shouldn't be able to, but you can target certain subreddits, certain interests. And so that even was some like A/B testing there of these particular subreddits have this particular like type of teenager who may also belong to this other subreddit. You can't target the like teenager specific subreddit, but you can target like proxy ones around that. And same with TikTok too, because you can target like on an interests level and on a demographic level too. And then it's also playing around with the assets as well. I'm like in pilot mode of another product that's like ITO, but more for young women, to realize if they're in like coercive or emotionally manipulative relationships with men earlier rather than later to, again, have the end goal of preventing harm. But that's a little bit like those ads have to look really fundamentally different than the ones that are attracting like teen boys. Yeah. And so another thing I started working on is having a different product actually be like the top of funnel to ITO. So that's actually where I came up with the idea of making like a pretty small web game where that's easier to advertise on Reddit. More people will click on something that looks like a game, which is actually just like a simulated text message scenario where once you open the game, you pick a friend to talk to, like it's really just an avatar and you can have a group chat or you can have a one-on-one text. And that friend is usually going through an ambiguous like sexual or dating scenario that kind of gets the user thinking about potentially their own scenarios with those like pause moments, reflection moments baked in. And then the game actually takes them to the ITO like homepage so that if they are starting to think about their own scenarios. So like trying to find a way to feed my own flywheel a bit, but using it in a way that is like probably going to have a higher click-through rate as it's a game, as opposed to calling it like a consent reflection tool on Reddit is like probably not going to have the highest click-through rate for these particular demographic.
I could see an avenue. I know high schools and like eventually this could be rolled into a health education or a sex ed class program.
We talked about it a little bit, like corporate training too. Like it's corporate training has always tried to be more interesting than just corporate training. And this is a really like unique modality to engage a very specific customer set. And so I feel like there's, tons of applications for like schools, camps, programs, like
sports teams, youth groups, sports, mind.
Totally, locker rooms,
college,
et cetera.
Teams.
I think I remember in college we used to do college EDU or like Greek life EDU. There was some kind of alcohol EDU.
Greek.
There's lots of applications of like programming trying to get in front of these groups that need some, need to make sure that they are getting some guidance, because we can't assume everyone came from communities that cared and wanted to give them all that input.
Tell me a little bit from an organizational standpoint. I know it's a fairly new organization. You're in an incubator. This doesn't seem like the type of product you're eventually going to monetize. Mm-hmm. How are you thinking about funding? I know you're a nonprofit. Tell me a little bit about what you're thinking there. Maybe listeners.
Well, first, the incubator is actually coming to a conclusion in the next couple of weeks. One of the founders of the incubator or of the fund, she also went through YC many years ago when she started her own tech nonprofit. And so that was her whole goal, was like, how do we YC-ify like philanthropic causes? And so we're going to have a demo day, a pitch day, where they're inviting family foundations, donor advised funds and things like that to give potential grant money to like myself and the other teams in the incubator. So that'll be a good like opportunity, but also just like always fundraising always applying to some of these open calls for grants. That's like a big strategy, I guess, to collect money. But the other thing I'll say is definitely the consumer side. I don't plan on monetizing, but I do have like an end state goal of making this again like the institutional API layer, like some sort of engine where you can achieve the same goal with consumers, but have that integrated with maybe it's schools, maybe it's other youth serving orgs, maybe it's other tech platforms that like a lot of kids or teenage age are already at, and we can do like proactive message management if the API or the licensing layer is like able to actually identify something like that. So that's kind of, not that I have necessarily a goal of generating revenue, but there are pathways open, even if you keep this particular set of wedge products as free to consumers or free to like the end user. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, and colleges certainly have money to pay for something like this for their athletes, for sure. Yeah, you got my wheels spinning now of like how I would, really fun. Okay, I know we spent a lot of time on the problem space and on kind of the domain and how you're reaching people. Is there anything even like on the technical side or as a nonprofit or just anything that we haven't covered that you wished I had asked you?
I think in terms of just like the consumer product, I do think there was a lot of consideration in that, like how it looks and how, like even we talked about the cookie consent, like making sure it looks like it's incognito, it's private, no one's tracking you, and it's very easily navigated. Like something that I think we talked about back when we were first developing the first version of the UX is like, assume someone's using this when they're maybe inebriated or they're spiraling and spinning out and they need just like a way to mind dump, like making it very straightforward and not like a lot of clicks and not a lot of navigation or like carousels or very like customer facing UIs with like lots of images. It's like very basic to make it be more about what you need to share. So I think just that was very considered also in the CX.
I can imagine too that even if people click through an ad and they want to try it, any friction at all, they're going to run away because they're already like taking a risk. They're already probably a little bit, what is this? Do I really want to do this? So I can see how that would be really critical.
Yeah. And it's got to beat like going to Reddit and asking a bunch of strangers the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, what is it that Reddit has that's not appealing? It's like a public domain, a username attached to it, like observable, a bunch of strangers who are going to immediately, it's like the town square shaming kind of like, you don't necessarily want that in this kind of like delicate moment to get guidance, especially when you're being reflective.
The fact that people do it is that there's, despite that, they're still doing it shows a really big need.
Yeah.
But totally. I also wonder if the way that you just described it, Olivia, is not how they view it. They are posting there and they're sharing their story there. So they're getting something. This is very foreign to me. I have only had negative experiences on Reddit. So for me to relate to this was very challenging. But I suspect they see it differently. And it's probably a little bit of both, right? It is a real need and they see it a little bit differently. Reddit, for whatever reason, is a safe space for them to do this.
This is for the people who aren't comfortable posting on Reddit too.
Yeah.
Because they're like,
yeah,
it's too scary to put out there.
Yeah. And for everybody who's not, who is posting on Reddit, there's probably plenty who are not.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Priya, I think they're jump also, in there.
Yeah, just on the Reddit piece, something that we were working on was like the ideal tone of all of the is this okay responses is like if you're a teenage boy, your friend's older brother, which is like a very specific type of response, but it's like you want them to be wise and slightly more experienced, but still know where you're coming from because they were once a young boy too. I think that's actually the appeal of some of these particular subreddits because you'll have certain moderators that take on that persona of the anonymous older brother of your high school friend, and they can bring up their own experiences too. So like trying to match that, again, tonality, obviously they can't be like, yeah, this happened to me too, because it's not a human. But just, again, trying to match that kind of like sentiment so that it's like equally comfortable and equally validating, but also continues that or invites that continued reflection for the actual user.
Yeah. Yeah. I love how much intention and thought you're putting into this. It's like I said at the opening, I've really been thinking a lot about there's so many of us that have maker skills that can create things. And I'm really excited that we're hitting an era where we can make things that don't have to scale at the global level and like and be monetized to be worth the effort. And this feels like a really great example of a couple of people can get together and put their heads together and create something that it doesn't have to get the level of what you were saying, Priya. It doesn't have to be the intervention. It could just be another intervention.
Yeah.
And I think that's really powerful. And this is a theme that I've been really thinking about a lot. And I've already written an essay about it for my upcoming Sunday newsletter. And I'm giving a talk at the end of June. It will probably be about this of like, how can we all collectively tap into this tech for greater good? And it doesn't necessarily have to be, I'm going to quit my job and start a nonprofit.
Right.
Right. It could just be like, Olivia, you kept your job and you're contributing to a nonprofit, or it could be a side project, or it could be anything. Right. And I find that really empowering and maybe is a little way we can shape the future with AI that isn't just Sam and Dario and Elon get to decide the world for us. Because, man, that is not a world I want to live in.
Yeah.
Danielle is there, though, too.
True.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think also just to, it's funny being at the intersection of this world because the prevention space has actually been pretty conservative in its approach to adopting technology solutions for a lot of different reasons, right? It's also a big reason they're like pretty cynical about AI. Obviously, I'm like speaking with a broad brush. A lot of people are not cynical about AI. They want to believe in tools like these, but they will, sometimes they'll be on the end of the spectrum where it's what Olivia was describing before from a classical therapy standpoint, like one-on-one coaching or classroom consent education, something that is delivered in a very unidirectional way. And really, when you think about scaling, you're really thinking about like one class at a time in a particular high school is really the amount of scale you can get to. But I think there's a real opportunity here where, again, setting a precedent for building an AI product or an AI-driven product that is still safe and being able to reach that scale that the prevention space has always been like wanting to reach at that scale, but just being more comfortable and getting them more comfortable with adopting this technology solution or other technology solutions by showing how you can build these type of safe AI products. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about at the top of the hour too. Is technology good? It's good as an avenue. It can be bad in how you implement it, how quickly you implement it, how many trade-offs you made for safeguards in order to get to market faster, in order to grow revenue faster. So obviously this is very idealistic. I don't have revenue goals I have to hit or anything like that. So I can speak from a very ideal world. Let's just take our time and build it the right way. But not everybody has that luxury, but that's how I'm framing it when talking to other people in the prevention space who are a little bit more cynical of technology tools for this.
You know what? If people think about it as a job, they may not have that luxury, but I think everybody has this luxury to some degree. We all have hobbies. I know lots of people have a crazy busy job and kids at home, and I'm not trivializing. Not everybody has extra hours just hanging around, but a lot of people in tech do. And I
True.
think that this is something that starts to open the door to we can do more things for our communities rather than for the bottom line. And I think that's pretty compelling.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree with that.
All right. Thank you both for taking the time to share your story. It's been really fun to dig in and learn more about what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks
for the invite. Yeah, it was a great conversation.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and give us a rating as it helps others find the show. Thanks. I appreciate it.